This is the Need to Know podcast from the Computer Information Agency, with information for IT professionals. For more information and to download other shows, visit www.ciaops.com/N2K. This is episode 9 with Jeff Alexander. Welcome along to another podcast from the Computer Information Agency. I'm joined today by Jeff Alexander from Microsoft. Welcome, Jeff.
Hi, Robert. How are you going?
Not too bad today. I thought that we'd have a bit of a change of pace and we'd go back to an Aussie accent for a change. We've visited some people in the US and the UK, and I think it's time that our audience gets back to its Australian roots and understands that Australia is the centre of the universe.
That's true. I mean, I am from the US, as you know, Robert, but I've been here for a long time, so I'm a token Aussie, as they say.
Oh, okay. Well, look, I think your accent's strong enough for us to pass the test here. So, But speaking of that, Jeff, do you want to give us a bit of a background of you know, who you are, where you've come from, and your current role with Microsoft in Australia?
Okay. My name's Jeff Alexander. I'm an IT pro evangelist based in the Sydney office and for Microsoft Australia. I've been in this role for just over 5 years. I've been at Microsoft for 23. My background is I've done, you name the job at Microsoft, other than the managing director, I've done that. I've done technical pre-sales, I've done product support, I spent 6 years in Microsoft's internal IT department. So I have a strong IT background. Obviously spent a lot of time in this role talking to a lot of you guys in the small business space, but mainly focusing on server infrastructure like Windows, Windows Server, Windows 7, that kind of thing.
Okay, that's great. And generally, how do you find that role? Do you find that it's something that you know the general resellers are warming to? It's something they want information about. Is it that sort of role that's positive that you find?
You mean my role in the,
yeah,
in the company?
Yeah, your role.
Oh yeah, I mean it's a role that I don't have a revenue target, so I don't have to. When I come and talk to you guys or I come and talk to the guys, it's my role is about being a trusted advisor. So being on the edge of new technology and best practices of what we've seen out there. So it's a good role because I'm able to actually talk about what I want to talk about. But I have the experience of actually being a practitioner, being in IT roles. It's a very sought after role. A lot of people are waiting for me to leave.
Yeah, I was about to say it's a pretty unique role if you're not driven by a specific marketing target. So there you
we're
go.
Just handset and community reach, yep. Making sure we're reaching, and hence podcasts are a good vehicle for doing that. This is the second or third one of these I've done in the last 3 or 4 months. We did Tech Talk Radio, I think, a while back. Yep. And funny enough, they wanted to know about Home Server as well, which is interesting. So.
Okay. Well, since we've mentioned the product we were going to have a look at first, obviously Windows Home Server. It's been out for a little while in version 1, but obviously there's a new version coming out known as Vail. What can you tell us about this? You know, this product in general and the new release.
Well, the new release is almost a rewrite from the ground up, in a sense that Windows Home Server, as you know, that has been a product been around for quite some time, built on a fairly older platform for Windows, which is Windows Server 2003 R2. So it's built on an older platform, and it was really primarily brought to market to help home users be able to back up their PCs and have a central storage system, much like a NAS, but does a little bit more than that. So it does the complete PC backup and all that kind of thing. Vail was rewritten on Server 2008 R2, so they didn't want to continue on the existing platform. So it's been rewritten from the ground up to run on 2008 R2, and some of the significant changes to that, obviously it's a newer operating system. And for the home market for Vail, it's using a technology called SMB2, which I'm sure you know about. Which we know that a lot of people are moving much larger files around their home networks, funny enough. I mean, I have about 4 or 5 terabytes of data that I have here in my home office, and we're seeing that storage is being driven out of the home quite a lot these days. So that's just a much more modern and more efficient protocol for moving larger files around. They've rewritten the dashboard interface from scratch to be a much more modern and more Windows 7-like interface. Also, we're tightly integrated into the Windows 7 libraries that are in Windows 7, so that we have that tight integration with those. We also have support for DLNA, which is the industry standard for moving data around to different devices that support that. I think there's some monitors that support DLNA, which is a standard to move data. So to be able to say, okay, I've got a monitor in the lounge room, I want to stream media to that monitor. And by home server supporting, Valve supporting that, it allows us to centrally store the media on that home server and then deliver it to different devices around the home.
Okay, so the existing product or the one that's coming out, how do we get that? Is it something you just buy, go down to the local technology shop and just buy it off the shelf?
The HP, our major partners for this is that it comes pre-packaged on a server that you buy. So the server that the most popular one is the HP Media Smart Server. They retail in Australia for around $600 or $700, depending upon how much storage you actually get with the initial device. The Media Smart's an interesting device in the sense that it's about 4 coffee cups high. You drink coffee, right?
Yep. I think everybody does who works in IT, don't they?
Yeah, that's true. So I don't, actually, funny enough. So it's about 4 coffee cups high. It's a very small, low-power device. Comes with 1 gigabyte of memory and 1 terabyte of storage. The idea of it is that we want to make sure that home users can easily add storage to the device. So if their storage needs grow, they just go to their local computer store, buy themselves a 3.5-inch drive, and they just slot that into the drive. Easy done. And the home server console will automatically recognize that you've added a new drive, and I will ask you to go through a wizard to add that to the total storage pool. And the way that we actually do that is through the drive extender technology. The drive extender technology gets rid of all the drive letters that we currently have in operating systems today.
Okay.
So essentially what that means is that you have a single drive that is just your storage. We create a system partition of 20 gigabytes, and then that the rest of it is used as storage for your pictures, for your music, for all the kind of stuff that people keep on their PCs. And generally when I talk to people about home server, I ask them, how many PCs have you got in your house? And if they say 2 or 3, and I go, do you have stuff on those PCs? And they'll say, yeah. And I go, do you ever back up? And that's where you tend to get the no answer. I've had cases here with my wife's PC where she's had an issue with the PC, and I'm able to do a bare metal restore of that machine.
Mm-hmm.
And take it back to a point in time where the machine was working, boot off a recovery DVD, and about a half an hour, 45 minutes or so, have her machine back to a working state with all her data intact and everything good to go. So that's something that gives you that good WAF factor, or WAF approval, the WAF accepting factor.
Exactly. So can I ask, why would you look at home server and not something like a dumb NAS, just a big storage box sitting in the corner? What are the benefits of the home server? Obviously, there's the backup component, which you've spoken about, but what else are the benefits of just buying, a big disk and sitting it in the corner?
One of the benefits is obviously with the existing version, you have a web page that you actually get. So as part of the home server product, when you actually get the PC, it asks you to actually set up a web page. And you get a certificate from GoDaddy, and you set a website up on homeserver.com. Two things that allows you to do is that allows you to create web pages to share photos with family and friends that are overseas. It allows you to remotely access those machines from outside the home. So if you and I travel a fair bit for our roles, so imagine you're away and something happens to a PC or something happens at home, you can remote into those machines through the home server website, and you can troubleshoot those issues. So it has a remoting component of that as well. So the other thing that you also have, obviously the bare metal restore is the biggest one, because a NAS will not actually do a bare metal restore of a machine. All that does is just store your data.
Mm-hmm.
So those are a couple of the reasons why you would actually do it. It's a fairly low price point when you look at it in price point compared to a NAS. I think if you go down to Harris Technologies or up to websites like OSPC Market or whoever HP actually sells through, they sell these home servers at fairly reasonable prices. Also, Acer makes one as well. Lenovo makes one in the UK. I'm not sure if they ship that out here. OSPC Market also make specific ones that they put together for you, kind of thing. So.
And the clients that it connects to, obviously, it supports the Windows. But firstly, what version is the minimum of the operating system? Does it go sort of how far back does it go? And what's its support like for, obviously the Apple devices, things like Macintoshes?
Doesn't support Macintoshes. It supports XP and above. So XP, Vista, Windows 7. So what happens is that we install the connector software on the machines, and then we connect to the home server through the connector software. So that's and plus what we've seen also is there's a thriving marketplace for developers that are writing plugins for home server.
That's what I was going to ask you about. The next thing was the add-ons. I believe there's a whole swag of add-ons that can be added into home.
Oh server. Yeah, and there's a lot of integration into home automation and that kind of thing. I have one on here called Router Control, which allows me to see what's going on with my router. The idea of the home server itself is that we try to make the addition of storage. They were very specific about how the devices were built from an OEM perspective. Had to have four drive bays, had to have four USB ports at the back. So when you think about adding storage to these devices as the devices grow, very easy process for it to actually do. I'm not sure how when you get a NAS, if you buy a 2 terabyte NAS, I'm sure is it similar process? You just buy a disk and add it to the.
They vary, but I think, at the low end of the consumer market, it comes up with a web page and you can plug in some details and do the connection. Obviously, it hasn't got a lot of the smarts, but it's a matter of, the big benefit, obviously, I see probably in the home user environment is obviously, the backups and perhaps the remote access.
Yep.
And I think, like I said, perhaps just moving that into the small business market, I mean, I think there seems to be a thriving thriving area for incorporating the home server into a small business server environment to do workstation style backups.
There has, and we've seen that. I've been talking to a lot of your colleagues from the SBS user group and other guys that I know. There's been a lot of cases where we've seen home server making its way into small businesses. So with Vail, we're releasing in the Vail timeframe. We're releasing three different products. We're releasing Vail, which is designed for home users. Then we're releasing Aurora. And Aurora is essentially the same product as Home Server, except that it has the domain capability. Whereas Home Server, each machine is in a work group. But with Aurora, we're supporting that in small businesses of up to 25 users. And you have the domain capability. And then you move on up into SBS 7, which has all the stuff that you know today in Small Business Server, Exchange, all that kind of stuff. So Aurora is kind of sitting in between where you would see SBS and Home Server, so that we have a version of the product that does all the backup that can be used for small businesses.
Okay, so I suppose a question that people have asked me, and I must admit that I probably can't answer, is down at the this low end of the market, the 10 to 15, 10 to 25 users, you've got a lot of choices if you're a small business. You've got Home Server, you've got SBS, you've got Aurora, you've potentially got SBS 7, you've got Windows Server. There seems to be a lot of products in this relatively small area. Is there any way to make it easier for people to decide what suits them?
It's going to be the licensing, essentially. It's going to be where we, how many licenses it supports. So Aurora will support up to 25 users, whereas, SBS goes much higher than that. Home Server supports up to 10.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the differentiator is that, we figured with a Home Server, hopefully you don't have more than 10 machines at home. I have six. I'm getting close. But that's an unusual case. You know, most families will have, you know, maybe four PCs or something like that, four or five PCs. So we feel that the home server will fit that marketplace quite well. But then when you get into a small business, you look at something like Vail, but you might not actually need everything that's in SBS. You might not need, the Exchange. You might have your Exchange hosted in the cloud, for example, mm-hmm. That kind of thing. So that's where we're kind of differentiate. I mean, I'm not a licensing or a marketing person, but that's from what I've heard from Rosemary Stark, who's the product manager in Australia.
Yep.
For the product, we're actually having a conversation today about about Vail. Next year, so.
So how do, for example, how does the home server product do its updates? Does it update just the server, or can you get it to update the workstations as well? How does it handle those sort of things?
It does the updates for itself. It doesn't push updates out to the clients. That's where something like Windows Intune would be something that you would look at. That's our cloud management system for Windows 7. So that particular product is not necessarily designed for the home. It's designed for small to medium businesses as well. So that, you know, if you have a small business that doesn't have a lot of IT folks, you can run Windows Intune, which is basically WSS for the cloud. And essentially what that does is it allows you to push updates out to users' machines from a single web browser, no matter where you are as the administrator. Home server doesn't do any of that stuff. It doesn't do any of the updates.
Is Intune available down here in Australia yet?
No, it's not been released yet. We're looking at, I think, Q3 next year, I believe, is when the time frame is.
Okay. But it is out in other regions.
No, not yet. They're still in the final stages of release, I believe. I haven't seen anything on that. I did some stuff on Intune a while back, but we have a couple of customers on pilot here in Australia, but right now it's not, and it's the way that we sell BPOS in Australia that's the differentiator in that space.
Okay. Yep. All right. So, again, in this sort of market space, do you how are you finding the uptake of, you know, the home server? Do you find it's a growing product? Is there more demand for this? Do you find, with obviously all the media demands and the integration to video and things like that, is it a growing market? Do you see?
We do see it growing probably more in the US and the UK have taken it up. I mean, in Australia, it's probably still more of a Technogeek type product at this point in time, because when you talk about it as a server, people kind of go, well, why do I need a server? They don't understand the term server and what that actually means. So I think we still have to do a better job of explaining to people what this actually means. So in Australia, I know a fair few people that run it at home, no problems, but they're mainly technical folks.
Mm-hmm.
In the US, we see it's being taken up more, and also in the UK as well. We wouldn't be continuing the product if we didn't see a market for it. And where we see the market, though, is that there's a lot of people with multiple PCs. So there is potential. And what people struggle with is the backup of their PCs, as you probably know.
Mm-hmm.
Is that they don't know how to go about backing it up. I mean, there's all kinds of different ways to put your data on SkyDrives, to put your data on products like Carbonite or Jumbo, all these kind of different ways to back up stuff in the cloud. But how do you back up it? How do you protect your machine in case of a catastrophic hard drive failure? And that's where a home server can fit that need.
Yep. Okay, well, like I said, I think it seems to be that it's a... Like I said, I think the acceptance is it's generally a geek product, and most people who are technically savvy are running it. I think obviously the OEM hardware makes a big difference too. I mean, having a pretty server sitting in the corner is a lot more appealing to a lot of people. I think that's part of the issue as well. It needs to obviously fit into the decor of a living room rather than a dedicated server room.
That's right, and they do. They tend to look at... The design of these drives, the way that these actually, you know, the way it actually works is these machines look really quite, you know, quite nice to sit in the corner. They're very small, They're very attractive looking, and that's why they they're taking it very quiet. That's the other thing, is that they run with low power processors, like Intel Atom processors and stuff like that. The other thing about Val, I must point out to you, is that it is a 64-bit only operating system.
Mm-hmm.
So we're moving towards that. Same as Server 2008 R2 in the new server operating systems.
Okay, so on another score, if someone was had a developer a bent and decided that they'd like to create a plugin or an add-on for Home Server and maybe Aurora, is that the SDKs and all that sort of stuff available? Is it easy to get into that sort of area, do you think?
Yeah. There is an SDK available for this, for developing add-ins, so that's not a problem at all.
Okay, and does Microsoft on the Home Server website or something have a list of these add-ins, or how do we find the add-ins? Are they available through the console in Home Server? Is that the easiest way to find them?
Yeah, if you go to Microsoft.com/Home Server, and then there's a link to the Home Server add-ins page. Another good resource for Home Server is a website called wegotserve.co.uk.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's a funny name, but they're a UK site that of MVPs. They have a lot of different add-ins that you can actually get. Obviously the add-ins and they've also done a very comprehensive review of Val. The one thing that's missing from Val is no media center capability within the product itself. And that was something that there was a lot of rumors going around about that. There was a lot of talk of people wanting to combine media center and home server into the one product.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not something we're doing in this release.
So is there anything else that you, like I said, that you want to let people know about, obviously the existing product or the Val product? Can you give us any idea of when we might see the Val product actually available for purchase?
It's going to be second half next. It's going to be probably Q3, Q4 next year. So right now you can go to connect.microsoft.com and you can download the beta and you can play around with it. I'm actually running Hyper-V at home, and I'm running the Val beta in a virtual machine just to test it out and see. And I'm remoting into my machines through that. It's not a problem at all. I don't tend to use it for anything but backup and also remoting into the machines. So you can play with it in a virtual machine, and obviously we recommend doing that because you don't want to compromise your data because it's still a beta product.
Okay, and if someone's already got a Home Server version 1, is it basically going to be a new hardware, obviously, because it's got to be 64-bit. You can't do an in-place upgrade even if the hardware supports it?
No, at this stage I don't know what the upgrade process is going to be at this point in time. I think it's a bit too early yet at this point. I mean, obviously, there is not going to be no upgrade from 32-bit to 64-bit. And also the existing hardware has to be able to support 64-bit. And the processor you're going to need is an X64 processor, a 1.3 gigahertz processor that you're going to need as a minimum. So that's just when you're looking at a home server now, make sure that home server will have existing support for 64-bit. And a lot of the new ones, a lot of HP ones, are 64-bit capable anyway.
Okay, and how much RAM are you looking at? Obviously there's a minimum, but what's a good amount of RAM do you recommend in these boxes?
Minimum of 1 gigabyte of memory for Val. 512 for the current version of Home Server. Most of the media smarts come with 512 or a gigabyte. One of the things I didn't mention is that there will be in the Val version, there'll be a new video format to allow you to watch high definition videos remotely over the website.
Mm-hmm.
Using Silverlight, and that would require a decent amount of memory. 2 gigabyte would be recommended for that.
Okay, well, memory is relatively cheap these days anyway, so...
Of course, yeah. It's actually, because it's only really a file server with doing some stuff underneath, there's not a lot of impact on the server itself.
Okay.
And, when we do the backups, the first backup, if you have 5 machines in the household that are all running Windows 7, when we do a backup, we do a single instance. We use a single instance storage, so we don't duplicate all the files that are the same. So we'll only backup one version of the program files, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So that saves you on storage.
Okay. And so it basically, Aurora is exactly the same as Val, except it has the Active Directory component. Correct. Is that correct?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, it has the Active Directory component.
Okay. All right. Well, I think that, like I said, I think it's a product out there that a lot of people are looking at, you know, for some home uses, but also in the small business that it can go and back up the remote, you know, the remote machines. And obviously, you know, Aurora includes that ability to back up those machines, doesn't it, Jeff?
Yeah.
Okay. Now,
the next version, like when I go to when Vail is released, I will probably be dumping my Hyper-V that I've got here. And I will be putting Vail. I haven't decided whether I'm going to do Vail or Aurora. It just depends on how much I want to actually manage in my home. That's the way.
And is it safe to say that the other difference would be that Vail obviously is up to, Vail or home server will be up to 10 users, where Aurora allows you up to 25?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you can, in a small business, you can back up 25 workstations using Aurora.
Yes.
Okay, so there's apart from the Active Directory integration side of it, is also the fact that you can now back up 25 workstations with Aurora rather than Vail. So,
okay. Yeah, right.
All right. So, what I'd like to also turn our attention to and get your feedback and some information on is obviously the release now of Windows Phone 7. You were just telling me before we started that it was released in the US today. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's been released in Australia for a couple of weeks. You can go to Telstra and Vodafone stores right now. You can go to mobicity.com.au and buy unlocked phones. Actually, let me load that site up and I can see exactly what ones they have available. They have quite a lot now. So I think what one you were talking about was the Samsung.
Yeah, the one that I've heard a lot of good things about is the Samsung Focus. Apparently that's, you know, got a lot of, you know, like good hardware, very light, very small, is very popular, I believe, with a lot of Microsoft people in the US. So that's what I've heard to be the phone. You said that you have one, or you were getting one, didn't you, Jeff?
I do have one, thanks to my wife being very flexible about me. What I did is I went to the Telstra shop, and I am using her phone for the time being because I got her a phone on the $0, $49 cap with Telstra, and I'm just testing that at this point in time, as they say. Mm-hmm. And so I've got a HTC Mozart, and it's a nice phone. It's very thin, 8 gigabytes of onboard storage, which these days probably doesn't sound like a lot. And it's great. I mean, the interface is spectacular with the new tile interface. Is a totally different. I mean, if you look at how we did this, we reset. There's an article out today that we basically did a Control-Alt-Delete in December of 2008. They didn't like the direction we were going with Windows Mobile 7, and they dropped that project altogether and brought in some new people, Joe Bilafori, some other guys in there to kind of think about how we were actually developing phones, because previously we were really developing phones for OEMs. For the OEM handset manufacturers, not the end user. Windows Mobile, prior to this, was really too much in the user's face that they had to deal with. There was too many icons, too many things to do. It was an outdated interface. So they basically went back to the drawing board, and in 6 months, they kind of came up with the plan to develop an operating system in a year's time. So that's where Windows Phone 7 was born. And if you've seen a Zoom device, which is our audio player, it's very much similar to that as far as the way the screen actually works.
Yeah, it's in some ways it's similar to the Xbox, where, you know, you go up, down, left, right as well too.
Yeah, it's a whole different change in the way that we look at UIs. I mean, there's this concept called the Metro UI, which is a typography type user interface, in the sense that we use. The font that's used throughout Windows Phone 7 is Sequoia UI Lite, and it's more icon-based. It's very pleasing to the eye. They went to the big tiles, the thing that we used to do with Windows Mobile is we didn't have as many restrictions on the handsets and how manufacturers could use Windows Mobile on their handsets. Think of Google. Think of the Android operating system right now. Right, there's so many different handsets that are out there right now for Android. Android runs good on some handsets, doesn't run good on others. developers have complained that it's hard to develop because of the different types of devices that are out there. What we did is we went back to the drawing board and said, right, we're going to do more like what Apple does with the iPhone, in the sense that we're going to lock the system down to some certain standards that we want to actually adhere to. The first one being the processor. It needs to have a 1 gigahertz Snapdragon processor. It needs to have three buttons down the bottom. And this HTC Mozart that I've got in front of me right now, it has the back button, the Windows button, and the search button. So those are the only buttons that are on the screen itself. And we've locked that down so that there's a more consistent experience for the user. So when you buy a Windows Phone 7 device, you're going to get the People Hub. You're going to get messaging. You're going to get your email. You're going to get Office. For this particular one, because it's a Telstra handset, I get the Telstra One application on the home screen. And you get Internet Explorer, Xbox Live, your photos, and your calendar. And you can go and customize. If you don't like those panels, you can go and put your own panels on there. Okay, so the idea is to be able to personalize the phone so that's your phone. For example, I have my wife, I have my sister on the home screen so that I can get in contact with them fairly quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. It's funny enough, you know what's really interesting about this, Robert, is I'm actually getting my gamer tag points up more than I did on Xbox. Because when I'm home, the kids don't let me near the Xbox. So because these games are, because you have Xbox Live, you have games, these games are linked to my gamer tag. So if I play the games on the device, like if I'm at the doctor's or I'm sitting in an airport waiting for a plane or whatever, I get my points go up. So that's a good thing.
I think that you know, what I've heard, you know, about the Windows Phone, I think that, you know, the general consensus was before it came out, was that, you know, the Microsoft side of it wasn't also ran. It was going to be very difficult, if near impossible, for Microsoft to come back, compared to the strength, obviously, of the iPhone, and then obviously with the Android and its open, you know, the way that it's being pushed as an open solution. But I think the people that, you know, the reviews I've seen, the people that I've heard talk about it, I think that Microsoft have achieved, you know, they've done something that nobody expected. And I think the best description I've heard of it is that, you know, the Windows Phone 7 basically sits in between the iPhone and the Android. It's not the anarchy of Android where you've got, you know, 5 billion different apps in the App Store, but, you know, 400 million of those are just total junk, or they're just screensavers, or they're, you know, whatever. Versus the other side of the coin, where you've got an Apple situation where they control the hardware and the software and the App Store, you know, and they're very tightly regulated, and obviously they can control the pricing much more. So I think that it would seem that Microsoft's, you know, hit that mark, and it's aimed at a consumer audience rather than perhaps a techie audience, which the Android is perhaps more aimed at. And I think also too, I think the big thing that makes it so powerful is the fact that when it's tied into a Windows Live ID, which, you know, most people in the Microsoft environment use these days, it automatically brings all that information to your phone. So if you set it up in Windows Live and you've linked your Twitter, you've linked your Facebook, you linked your Xbox gamer tag, all of a sudden that stuff comes straight onto your phone. There's no configuration, other configuration.
That's right. And, you know, when I set this machine up, set this this phone up, it basically asked me a couple of questions. First was, what's your Live ID? And, of course, when to do the Live ID, it pulls in Facebook. It pulls in all my Live contacts. It pulls in my gamer tag. And then the next thing is, you know, do you want to add an Exchange account to it? And I didn't have to put in my Exchange OWA server. I just typed in my username and credentials, and bang, my corporate email was there. It was just, and I've been doing Windows Mobile since the original Windows CE devices, and this was just dead easy. It was just so easy to set up. I couldn't believe how quick it was to set it up.
Well, I think that seems to be the general consensus, and I think that, you know, the people who are savvy in this environment are saying, well, look, you know, these phones are personal devices. They need to be set up by the average person, not by, you know, the super uber geek sort of thing. So I think that's a very powerful feature that Microsoft may have captured that perhaps some of the others have overlooked.
Yeah, I think so. And we've the way that we've done this is obviously, as you know, sort of looking at any of the reviews, is we've rethought how the UI needs to look. And you've probably seen the ads that are coming out now. They're kind of pitching it as a phone to rescue us from our phones.
Yeah, very clever ads, I must admit.
And the fact that you get glance and go type capabilities, that you can see right on the home screen that you whether you have email, whether you have text messages, whether you have updates from Facebook through the People Hub, the Twitter app. Twitter has written an application, a certified application for a Windows Phone. It's a really nice application. You get all your calendar items, your pictures. The marketplace has now, and when we think about the apps, apps being a very big thing about these types of devices, is that we released probably, I think at launch, was 777 apps at launch, which was the largest for any smartphone launch in Australia. And today I think that has gone up to 2,000 with the launch of the device in the US. So we're already up to 2,000 applications. I think, you know, when you think about iPhone, the number of they do make a lot of comment about the number of applications that they have in their store. And you made a comment before about how there's a lot of crappy applications that are useful for like 1 minute, like this lightsaber application that I always see on an iPhone. And how often do people actually continue to use these apps? And I refer to that as stickiness of the application, keeping the application on the device and keeping it used. A lot of people install applications on iPhone, but they don't tend to use them or keep them on the device. So we're trying to make sure that we have quality applications. You know, we've still got a lot of those farting applications that are still out there.
Yeah, look, you're going to get those, but I think the examples that I've seen is Android, and Android's probably the offender in the market because it's so open and there's no there's no regulation placed on any of the apps or any vetting of the apps. You end up with all sorts of questionable apps, and to an extent that then makes it difficult to find the good stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think there needs to be some sort of quality control, but in other cases it probably doesn't need to be the same level of quality control that Apple may be imposing on some of its developers. So I think, again, Microsoft's hit the middle ground quite well. I think that, like I said, it's aimed the phone at the average person. I think that the ability to bring down all that information, linked to a live ID, is spectacular. It allows you just to use the device, as a device. You can move from phone to phone quite easily.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing too, that from a business side, that rings my bells, is obviously the integration with SharePoint, but also the integration with Office and Office web apps.
Yeah, that's right.
Can you give us a bit of background, a bit of idea on that sort of thing, how it works?
Yeah, yeah. The SharePoint stuff, the SharePoint integration, obviously the Office Hub is the one of the hubs that we have on the main screen. And when you go into the Office Hub, you get OneNote, you get your Office applications, Word, Excel, PowerPoint, and you do get your SharePoint integration. We haven't enabled this internally yet, so I haven't been able to play around with the SharePoint side of things yet. But we do have the capability to do SharePoint workspaces and get access to SharePoint sites as well.
Well, many of the demos also show the ability to, pull a document from a SharePoint site and then start editing it or viewing it. I mean, obviously it's a bit difficult on a small device, but, I think that's, in an emergency, in the flight lounge of an airport, when you've got to make that last change, that is definitely something worthwhile, I think.
Yeah, and I've had a look at some of the stuff that they've been talking about. From the phone itself, the initial launch of the phone has been a very big consumer idea, because when you look at where Windows Mobile was before, it was a very unconsumer friendly operating system. So first order of business is to make sure that this is a phone that consumers are going to desire and they're going to want to use. Okay, so, and if you look at the marketplace, there's still a very small amount of the marketplace that actually uses smartphones, what we classify as smartphones. That's a thing, is to try to get more people, more of the consumers, onto smartphones. But there still is an enterprise focus to this. Like, I've seen some initial reports, the fact that Windows Phone 7 doesn't tether, and it doesn't allow external micro SD storage cards. And that's a security thing. That is a security thing for the enterprise, in that we're not allowing people to be able to access data on the device through tethering and through the use of external storage cards. So that was something that was directly related to an enterprise thing, is to make the devices more secure. And you know, so that's why you see the HTC Mozart, a lot of these devices coming with 8 gig of memory, and there's no expandability of that. Now, at first, I was kind of like, wow, that kind of sucks. I had a 16 gig device before, and now I'm back, I'm half of that. But when I look at it, I don't need to store photos on this device because everything's on Facebook, everything's on Windows Live. So that is a different way of actually thinking about where data is actually stored on the device.
Yeah, my understanding is that you know, the actual SIM or the memory SIM is actually behind the battery, or has to be behind the case, so it can't be opened.
Correct.
I think that you can also, if you do want to upgrade, you can put a, you know, a bigger SIM in it, provided it meets the specifications. But once you do that, it needs to basically, you know, reset the phone and reload everything. So,
and I believe you avoid warranties and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I think the other thing too I've heard is that the performance of the phone very much depends on that SIM. So again, if you get a SIM that isn't supported or not fast enough in the way it accesses memory, the phone can perform very badly. So I think you're right. I think the SIM that comes with the phone will typically be, you know, should be more than enough than what you want for the life of the short life of that phone probably. And again, most of the stuff can move into the cloud or into other areas that you can access with the phone. So, I think, you know, you can't please everybody with everything. I think, again, you've got to look at it from the, you know, the what the majority of people want and how they actually use the phone. I don't think there necessarily be people who want that much memory. There's always going to be a small level that will, but not everybody needs that much, you know, that.
Yeah,
much.
And a lot of people talk about that from the music perspective, is that, you know, because it's got Zoom capability in the devices, they want to store a lot of music on it. But, you know, I have a Zoom, a separate Zoom device, because I don't want to be wearing out the battery for my phone. At the end of the day, it's a phone. And that's probably the primary thing, is that, and we went mainly focusing on the different hubs that we've got, you know, the people hub, the messaging hub, the email hub, the office hub, the games hub, and the games are spectacular. I've played a few of the games, and they are. I was just playing Need for Speed Undercover this morning, because that just came out today, and you just steer the car by moving the device, because it's got an accelerometer on it, and we've got an eight megapixel camera and 720p video on this device.
Well, I think that's the other thing that makes the Microsoft phone a bit unique here, is the fact that it's, you know, it's the only device probably that ties into this Xbox Live experience, this online gaming experience. And I think that is going to probably, again, it's going to be a big differentiator in the market. As much as, you know, people would like to admit they don't play games, I think that is a big market, and, you know, the video game market is bigger than the movie market. So it's a huge market, and I think, again, Microsoft's probably aimed that integration is something very powerful, only something Microsoft can do.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, I have my gamer tag there, and any updates I do on the device are reflected on the Xbox console. So you know, we've got a very good model with Xbox being able to, you know, the software plus services model for Xbox has been something I think we've done an excellent job over the last few years. And,
so
it's been something great to push down to the phone.
So here's a question that you probably can't answer officially, but I'd still appreciate an opinion, or, you know, whatever you can give us or give the listener. Obviously, if the phone's a, you know, a success, which it seems it will be, and goes into the market, obviously the hot button at the moment seems to be the tablet device. Is it something that Microsoft's looking at, or that may happen, that a tablet device based on Windows Phone 7, or would it more likely be a tablet device based on, you know, Windows 7 itself, the normal desktop operating system, do you think?
Currently, right now, it's Windows 7. If you look at our partners like Tiga Tech, who, you know Hugo Ortega, who makes the Tiga version 2. So there's a number of Slate devices that are coming into the market. There's a company in Francis Forest that's just come out with a Slate. based on Windows 7 at this point. The only thing about that that I see that's going to be a little inconsistent is that each device is going to have its own touch interface at the front of it.
Oh, because you can't control the hardware. Okay, yeah, okay.
So, like, for example, the TigerTech does ThinX, and the other one does some other type of device. But currently, right now, we're looking at Windows 7 slates. You'll see more of these coming into the marketplace next year, and the devices I've seen so far are really nice. There's one you can buy at Officeworks, which is a Chinese mob that made it a while back. I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but I was in Officeworks probably 3 or 4 months ago, and I said to the guy, I go, what's that? That thing, and he goes, oh, that's the, you know, Windows 7 slate. And he hadn't seen it before, so we all grabbed it. He went out back and got one, and there's all of us standing around having a look at the device. And so they are coming out, and they're full-fledged PCs with Intel Atom processors and 2 gig of RAM and, you know, nice displays. And you're seeing those kind of things starting to hit the market more with Windows 7. I mean, because the thing about Windows 7 is we up the touch capability within the operating system. So it automatically recognizes that if the screen, the device has the capability for touch. We're also seeing a lot of our manufacturers making monitors, desktop monitors that have full touch capability. So you're seeing people like Dell and I believe Lenovo makes one as well, makes a device that's full touch capability.
Yeah, HP as well, I believe.
Kitchen type PCs and that kind of stuff. Because when you look at our kids, like my kids, that all they want to do is touch screens. So I'm forever telling them to not touch screens, but that's how they're going to end up interfacing with these devices in the future.
Mm-hmm. So yourself personally, do you see a role for a tablet in the technology gadget bag that you've got?
Yeah, I definitely want to get one. I just have to get it past my CFO, which is my missus at home.
Yep.
I'm getting one on eval pretty soon from a company that we had in the office there in French's Forest. I'll be getting one on eval probably in a couple of weeks. Hugo Ortega, as you know, makes the TigerTech Vision 2. He's Mr. Tablet, Mr. Mobile PC. So I think what's driven that, though, is the iPad. The iPad has certainly driven that marketplace where people want a device they didn't know they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I see a lot of people that have the tablet PCs, and various people use them for various reasons. A lot of people use tablet PCs to do a lot of reading with their RSS feeds and various other things. A lot of people use them for games or for watching movies and videos and stuff like that. But it's certainly the tablet PC, the iPad has actually driven a lot of that.
Okay, and you see that as a growing area for device in general. Okay,
absolutely. And you'll see more and more slates coming out early next year, and there's already slates coming out from different manufacturers. I just got to look up the guy that I'm getting a device from. I can't remember what the device was called. I can't remember off the top of my head, but I'll be getting one, and that device is an Intel Atom processor, 2 gig of RAM, 250 gig hard drive, I believe. So that's going to be an interesting device. It's called Evolve 3. Is the company. If you go to evolve3.com.au, they have a device that's coming out later this year, and that's a tablet device built on Windows 7 at this point in time.
Okay, well that's great, and I think that like I said we're probably drawing to our time limit at the moment. So, is there anything that you'd like to pass on to the listener, or anything that we need to watch out for, apart from what we've talked about today? Is there anything that basically you reckon that we all should be looking at or thinking about down the track?
Get a Windows Phone 7, and you won't go back. I can't emphasize, we're really in the game now with Windows Phone 7. It is a lot. I actually use my phone a lot more now for different things. I'm on Facebook more. It's just easy. It just works. The Bing Maps works really well. There's obviously a couple of things I don't like, but like you can't keep it on in the car and all that kind of stuff. But, this is a V1 product, but geez, it's a beautiful interface
Yeah, admittedly, I mean, I haven't used one or seen one, but everything that I've heard and the people who have got them and, you know, have used them and are knowledgeable, you know, and open-minded about it, definitely would back up those statements and say, look, you know, it really is become a player in the market, and it definitely is, you know, hitting the right marks. And you know, again, it's not trying to take away from the iPhone or the Android device. It's, you know, definitely more competition for that area, which makes the whole, you know, the whole space much better. So
yeah, and today is a good day because there's more applications now in the marketplace with the US launch of the devices through AT&T and other areas. It's launched in the UK as well, in New Zealand, and in Australia. And if you look at stock levels, that's evidence of how popular it is. Microsoft staff don't have them yet, mainly because of stock. They just can't keep up with demand. They're out in certain countries in Europe, and they're desperately trying to make more devices. So.
Okay, well, that's always a great sign. So.
Yeah. So you'll see that the HTC will be dedicated to Windows Phone devices through the end of the year because of the demand that's going on.
Okay. Well, that's the tip. You can, like I said, go out and start looking at the Windows, you know, Phone 7, and have a look at them in the shops. And if you get a hold of one, to obviously look at the new, you know, the new interface, definitely worthwhile. So that's
great. The shops you can look at it is Vodafone stores. There's the Telstra shop in George Street in Sydney, right in the middle of corner of George and King Street. There's the T-Life shop that's there. They have a big stand there, so they're there. You can go and have a play with the devices. And all the T-Life stores are in Brisbane, Melbourne, all around. I've heard from a lot of my community contacts that they're there, and there you can play with them and you can have a look.
Okay. Well, like I said, that's great. Okay, Jeff, to finish it off, where can people contact you if they need to get a hold of you? You've obviously got a blog address. Do you want to let them know what the best way to get in contact with you about any of this stuff, if we've got questions or whatever?
Best way to get in touch with me is through my blog on blogs.technet.com/Jeffa36, or you can ping me on Twitter, and I'm Jeffa36 on Twitter.
Okay, that's great. All right. Well, I'll take this opportunity to thank Jeff on behalf of everybody listening. I think that there's been a whole swag of information that we've got out of this, and I think that's going to be a benefit to everybody in the technology field. And we hope that we're able to call on you again in the future, Jeff, to come back on and, again, give us some more information about what's happening in the Microsoft sphere.
Yeah, sounds good, Matt.
Excellent. All right. Thank you very much for that.
No problem, good to talk to you, Robert.
You too. And thanks, everybody, for listening. This podcast has been brought to you by the SharePoint Operations Guide. For more information, visit www.wssops.com. To provide feedback on this podcast, visit www.ciaops.com/contact.